The Reverend Jerry Falwell was adamant. Preachers should keep out of politics. In 1965, this up-and-coming evangelical pastor from Lynchburg, in the heart of Virginia, gave a sermon entitled Ministers and Marches.
Believing in the Bible as I do, I would find it impossible to stop preaching the pure saving gospel of Jesus Christ and begin doing anything else, including the fighting of communism or participating in the civil rights reform. Preachers are not called to be politicians, but to be soul winners.
You couldn't be much clearer than that. But 14 years later, in 1979, Reverend Jerry Falwell was to be the founder of one of the most powerful grassroots religious movements in American political history, Moral Majority. Falwell had been aroused politically by what he saw as the godless drift of American life, and thousands more evangelical Protestants agreed with him. It was a gathering storm, brewing since the early 1960s. Many liberals were surprised by its vehemence, but that's because they'd failed to appreciate that evangelical Protestantism hadn't been killed off by the modern secular society. One sign was the growth of Bible colleges, which placed the teaching of Christian fundamentals ahead of all else. There were 144 of these colleges by 1950, almost triple the figure 20 years earlier. Equally important were Christian radio ministers like Charles E. Fuller, whose nationwide old-fashioned revival hour ran for more than 30 years from 1937. But the evangelical pastor who became part of the national mainstream was Billy Graham from North Carolina.
The largest crowd in the history of Yankee Stadium turns out to hear the Reverend Dr. Billy Graham. 92,000 New Yorkers jammed the huge arena, 2,000 more were turned away.
He developed a revivalist movement known as Youth for Christ. In the Cold War era, Christianity seemed an important weapon against atheistic communism.
This was one of the largest gatherings on record for the evangelist, a high point of Billy Graham's New York crusade.
With slogans like, geared to the times, but anchored to the rock, Graham's rallies used the razzmatazz of popular music, celebrities, quizzes, even magicians, but all building up to preaching the Bible by Graham himself. As he said,
"We used every modern means to catch the attention of the unconverted, and then we punched them right between the eyes with the gospel."
Fascinated by politics, Graham was personally close to both Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon. But he got badly burned by Watergate. Having been a loyal supporter of the embattled Nixon, he was so appalled when he finally read the transcripts of the White House tapes that he wept and threw up. Graham said later of Nixon,
"I had a real love for him. He seemed to love his country, love his children. I thought he was a man of such great integrity. I really looked upon him as the greatest possibility ever for leading this country on into its greatest and finest days. But then, the way it sounded in those tapes, he was just suddenly somebody else."
He also said in 1980 that in his earlier days,
"I tended to identify the kingdom of God with the American way of life. I don't think like that now."
But other evangelicals disagreed. They saw the story of the 1960s and 1970s as a relentless campaign to exclude God from the American way of life. They were particularly affronted by the Supreme Court decisions in 1962 and 1963 to outlaw all prayers and Bible reading from schools. The cases had been brought by the American Jewish Congress as a violation of the First Amendment upholding the separation of church and state. But in 1962, roughly half the states had laws requiring or allowing Bible reading in schools, and about a third of all school districts held daily devotional services. The court decisions were widely flouted, and millions of people, especially in the South, signed petitions for a constitutional amendment to protect school prayer. Another simmering issue was school textbooks, which became a national cause célèbre in 1974 because of events in Kanawha County, an obscure part of West Virginia. Textbooks for each year were approved by the local school board on the basis of teachers' recommendations, but they usually had to be selected from a state-approved list if the schools wanted to get state money. In 1974, the Kanawha County School Board nodded through a list of some 300 language and literature books, but these provoked the anger of Alice Moore, the Mississippi-born wife of an evangelical minister. Sweet Alice, as she was known sarcastically, made her points with aplomb. At one public meeting, she held up one of the books and declared,
"We have a lot of people from the community sitting here who have no idea what we are talking about. If we're going to put this in the classroom for students to read, surely someone here will read it."
After a long silence, a member of the textbook selection committee agreed to read out the item, a poem by E.E. Cummings. Said Moore,
"It was dealing with sexual intercourse and pretty explicitly. He read the poem, and there was a kind of stunned reaction. No one was saying anything. And then he said, 'Well, I think it's talking about sex.' And the whole room broke up in uproarious laughter. It was a great moment. I had made my point."
Alice Moore and her supporters objected to profane language, lack of patriotism, leftist leanings, and so on. Among the works they listed as improper were The Iliad, Paradise Lost, and Moby Dick. In September 1974, Moore organised a boycott of schools in the whole county and won the support of local coal miners, several thousand of whom went out on wildcat strikes. As tempers flared, there were fights, stonings, and acts of arson. Prominent national conservatives descended on West Virginia, and, less welcomely, also the racist Ku Klux Klan. After 2 months of upheaval, a compromise was reached, affirming most of the books, but with two important provisos. No students would be required to use any books that were objectionable to their parents on moral or religious grounds, and future lists of textbooks would be screened by a committee on which parents heavily outnumbered teachers. Many educators were appalled. One English teacher wrote,
"The American Library Association notes that book banning has risen remarkably during the last 5 years. The time has come for educators to deal with the motives underlying censorship and to anticipate problems before emotion rules out rational solutions. The alternative is to surrender control of the schools to the shrillest members of the community."
But Alice Moore and her supporters across the country saw the issue very differently. For them, this was an affirmation not just of Christian values, but of local democracy. The growth of Christian academies was another sign of the swelling tide. In this case, a main motive was clearly racist. These private institutions were a response to school desegregation. But the academies also reflected the desire, evident in the culture wars of Kanawha County, to have a curriculum which parents could control, embodying what were deemed to be Christian values. Reverend Jerry Falwell defended the school that his church in Virginia set up as a response to the Supreme Court ban on prayer.
"There were those who thought we were probably starting Lynchburg Christian Academy to have a white flight school. But from day one, I made it clear that Lynchburg Christian Academy would be for any and all who loved Christ and wanted to study under born-again teachers in a Christian environment with academic excellence."
By the late 1970s, Falwell was a nationally renowned figure, pushing Billy Graham out of the spotlight. One of Falwell's moral crusades was against the growing tolerance of homosexuality, again upheld by the Supreme Court and reflected in many sex education courses in schools. In one mailing, he told supporters,
"Gays were recently given permission to lay a wreath on the tomb of the unknown soldier at Arlington Cemetery to honor any sexual deviants who served in the military." That's right. Gays were allowed to turn our tomb of the unknown soldier into the tomb of the unknown sodomite.
So by the late 1970s, there were various moral issues that offended significant sections of conservative Christian opinion in the American heartland. In Washington, conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation pondered how to organize these grassroots Christians as a national force. The rallying point proved to be abortion. The Supreme Court decision in January 1973, Roe v. Wade, had made America probably the most liberal country in the non-communist West. Yet initially, it was Catholics who took the lead in opposing abortion, and this automatically turned off many evangelical Protestants. Only gradually were they persuaded to join in a broad Christian crusade. The crux was a meeting between Falwell and Catholic pro-life leaders led by Paul Weyrich at the Holiday Inn in Lynchburg. Weyrich made the initial pitch.
Out there is what you might call a moral majority. People who would agree on principles based on the Ten Commandments, but they've been separated by geographical and denominational differences, and that's caused them to vote differently. The key to any kind of political impact is to get these people united in some way.
Go back to what you said earlier. You started out by saying there is something out there. What did you call that?
I said it was a moral majority.
That's it. That's the name of the organization.
With Falwell's popular appeal and the organizing skills of men like Weyrich, the moral majority rapidly took off. Support from prominent evangelical pastors unlocked the large mailing lists of their congregations, which were then exploited to raise funds. At a meeting of a dozen leading preachers in Dallas, Billy Graham declared somberly,
"I believe God has shown me that unless we have a change in America, we have 1,000 days left as a free nation. 3 years."
The others agreed. Charles Stanley, another prominent TV evangelist, put his hand firmly on the table.
"I'll give my life to stop this. I'll give everything I've got to turn this country."
Almost everyone said they would take a lead. Billy Graham was almost alone when he said,
"I cannot be publicly involved. I can only pray. I've been burned so badly with the public relationships I've had, I can't afford it. But I care so much."
Graham spoke from bitter experience, but he was an older generation. For good or ill, the moral majority would take evangelical religion right into the heart of national politics.